While you're setting up, just some ground rules. Each of you has 15 minutes for presentation of your case. 5 minutes is reserved for rebuttal to appellate counsel if you want it. I know the parties ahead of you move the podium up or down, so please adjust it to whatever your height preference is. And I'll call the case for, oh, he is back. Thank you, Mr. Smoger. If you'll go ahead and call the next case for consideration.
Calling 824-0822, Shanzi, appellant, versus Oldenburg, respondent.
Good morning. May it please the court, Joseph Cantor appearing on behalf of Mr. Daniel this matter. This is a straightforward matter of relatively straightforward matter of an appeal from an order for protection hearing where at the close of the petitioner's case, my client's case, there was a motion to dismiss, which was ultimately granted, I believe, 2 or 3 days later by the sitting judge. The respondent did not.
Well, whether or not there was a motion to dismiss, the judge is going to presumably take it under advisement and issue a decision one way or the other, right?
That would be the normal case, especially if there had been a presentation by the defendant. In this case, the defendant chose to make a motion.
That I thought was a little odd because once a case is submitted, it's submitted. But I also thought was odd is your argument about the Rule 4102, which has to do with the jury trial. We have a court trial here. Can you explain to me why we would give all this great deference to your client's position?
Yes, Your Honor. The original brief was written by me and Mr. Maher after looking at the judge's decision, and the judge quoted those standards. And so we were applying the standard that the judge claims to have been applying. Now, in
thinking perhaps that was an improvident statement or something in the court order that was clearly an error, but not necessarily affecting the verdict or the outcome.
I think that under either standard, the district court made an erroneous decision. So, and in all fairness, there is another case that I found, and this was after the submissions were in, which did delineate that in a 4102B type of motion to a bench or to a sitting judge instead of to a jury, that it is a movable standard. So if it's a bare bones dismissal, then you apply the Rule 12 and Rule 56 jury trial standards of all the presumptions in favor of the non-moving party. If it's a detailed order, then it moves into the 5201. So it's not a set in stone. So I would say that on one end of the spectrum, you have a case where there's 28 findings of fact, 22 conclusions of law, and 5 orders. And then that becomes a judgment. That would standard. That would be under the 4102. No presumptions to the non-moving party. If it's a two-line order that says the motion's granted, then you have to make all the presumptions in favor of the non-moving party. Somewhere in between is where the line gets drawn.
So we have a court order, and our job as an appellate body is to review for an abuse of discretion, right?
That's correct.
So here's where I think your burden is. You have competing testimony. You have a social worker that says, okay, child reports and details a number of times there's been child reports and a prior false report by the boy. Dad says mom pushed him into the grill. Dad takes him to the hospital. There's swollenness, so on. We've heard all of that. And then we have the guardian ad litem who testifies and says, I can't tell.
Yep.
That this child is a pawn, my words, not the guardian's words, but a pawn between mom and dad that seem to have this engagement with each other where they want to continue to bring each other into court. So we have a district court that's made these findings. I'm getting somewhere. We don't reweigh the evidence. So what do you see us doing in regard to this conflicting testimony and the district court giving weight to the testimony that was presented at court?
Well, I think there's two issues there. One is I don't necessarily think that she gave weight or made credibility determinations. She made credibility determinations with regard to one person, the guardian. She did not make credibility determinations regard to Ms. Toonen or Ms. Upsall, who were the vice principal and the social worker. She did not make any credibility determinations as to the evidence that was contained within the medical reports. She just dismissed those out of hand. Now, on a de novo standard for misapplication of law, if you look at how she dismissed the medical records, she says they did not show any significant injury or visible injury, and that's not the standard. The standard is harm or infliction of fear of imminent harm or assault.
And counsel, what did they show?
They showed lacerations and possible muscle bruising that would not show visibly, and they treated it with lidocaine ointment.
But here's our finding of fact. The medical records and photographs, blah, 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 do not show any significant or visible injury.
Yep.
Well, how can we say it does? That's reweighing the evidence.
Well, first of all,
kids are kids. They get injured all the time.
No, they get injured all the time. I completely agree with that statement. It's the cause of the injury and the fact that there was an injury. So the abuse of discretion.
The cause of injury caused by what was alleged to have occurred.
Yes.
Throwing against, I can't remember what it was.
The grill.
The grill, thank you, Judge Working. But so one would have expected more serious injuries from that. So I would assume the district court's discussion about lesser injuries would indicate whatever the child got was not due to being thrown against the grill. Would that be a fair statement?
Well, if it is, then that violates 5201 because there's no specific finding as to that. All she's saying is that the medical records don't show a significant or visible injury, and that's not true. They show an injury, and they show a visible injury. So that is a clearly erroneous finding because it's directly against it. She's not weighing it. She's not saying, I don't trust the doctor because Dad was in the room. She's not saying, I don't trust the doctor because Mom was in the room. She doesn't say any of those things. She says the records don't show this. And they clearly do show that. And not only do they show that, even if they show a non-visible injury still satisfies the statute.
Child protection was notified, right?
That's correct, Your Honor, according to the records. So, yes, there have been CHIPS reports.
Yes.
There have been multiple CHIPS reports over the years, and there have been safety plans that have been agreed to by the parties that have also been ignored. There's a big history here, and I did come into this case, 6 years into it. So there is, I have a little more familiarity than you do, but there is a big history here. But the simple fact that we have here, Your Honor, is whether or not you apply the standard of all the presumptions in favor of the non-moving party or you don't, the clearly erroneous and abuse of discretion is met because. Let's take the statement from the district court judge where she says the appellant's testimony is self-serving and unsupported by any other evidence. It is supported. I mean, you even mentioned it yourself.
That's a question I have for you. What evidence is, what record evidence, point us to the strongest record evidence that supports your claim that there was an abuse of discretion by the trial court?
The statements that Ms. Toonen and Ms. Upsall made to the court that on various different dates, the child made statements that Mom injured me, I'm scared to go back to Mom's because I'm scared she's going to hurt me again, and I'm scared to go back to the hospital.
But the district court did acknowledge that the child may have said these things. In fact, the guardian ad litem said the child has said these things about being afraid of Mom.
The court didn't say that. The court said that they testified that he's dysregulated at school.
Yep.
That's all the court said. And so that is also contrary to the evidence. Both school employees who testified after having worked with this child for 4 to 5 years that he has been, they made statements that he's scared of Mom, that he's scared of going to Mom's house, and he's scared of being hurt. And he's scared of what will happen if the school contacts Mom. So we have multiple instances that completely contradict that finding by the court.
What did the doctor testify to?
The doctor didn't testify, Your Honor. We had both doctors.
Serve your case without him.
Well, this is going back to an earlier stage of these proceedings and the prior OFP. The district court judges, Judge Perchio before, I believe it was Judge Marks in this case.
Judge Marks, correct.
Had said, you can't use certified medical records, even with the custodian of records, so you have to have the doctor there. So we brought in both certified medical records and subpoenaed the doctor. The hospital said, we don't like having ER doctors come to court, use the certified medical records, but if the judge orders them to show up, we will comply. The judge said, well, we can order. At first she said, I don't have anything, Mr. Kanner, besides your word that you've been served, but then she saw I had filed the affidavits of personal service in Mindy's. So then she changed that decision and said, okay, well, if we're gonna have the doctors, we'll get a continuance, I'll order them here. And that's when counsel agreed to stipulate just to enter the medical records. And the medical records are the ones that showed the finding of child abuse from the December 14th incident. So it was—
And the doctor testified in the records indicated he had observed injuries.
Yes, exactly.
And isn't it true that for a medical opinion, there are two parts. One's a medical history, and the other's the observations at examination, correct?
That's correct.
And in this case, the observations at examination were, at least from the doctor, were that there were injuries and that it was child abuse.
That's correct.
And the medical history from the child to the doctor, that was that mom pushed me into the grill, and that's what caused these injuries.
That's correct.
So that's your strongest evidence, probably. Counsel, is that correct?
Yeah, yes. I would say that that's the strongest evidence from the medical perspective. In the two different prongs under the domestic abuse statute, injury or fear of infliction, I believe that's the injury or the assault. The fear would be the statements from Amy Toonen and Ms. Upsall. And those two statements are also corroborating evidence of the statements that were made to my client, Mr. Shands. But yes, that would be the strongest evidence because the doctor witnessed those and put them in his report.
But the district court acting as the trial judge, since there was no jury, was going to have to make the decision as to the weight and credibility of that evidence.
That's correct. So when you're considering the weight and credibility of the evidence, and you're looking at the difference between a 5201 standard and the standard, for all presumptions in favor of the non-moving party, I think that under either one, this court made an error. Now, you also have an argument under 5201 that the findings don't allow this body to have adequate review, and that's where we're getting into all these questions that we have is, well, couldn't the judge have found this? Couldn't they have done this? They weighed the evidence and they did this. If all we're doing here is speculating about what could have happened, maybe the findings aren't sufficient, and so therefore that's another reason to go back. I didn't brief that specifically, but that's one of the reasons why when you're talking about a spectrum of analyses on the right hand, or on my right hand side, there's no presumptions because the findings are detailed enough. And I just keep coming back to, there was no credibility determination identified in the order as to the medical records, as to Ms. Toonen, as to Ms. Upsall, or any of those people. The judge simply said the injuries don't appear serious and are superficial. So, and that's not the standard under the domestic abuse statute. I'll just look at my notes real quick. I know I have 2 minutes left. The guardian ad litem did testify, and this is something that the judge put a little bit of weight on in her order, that the guardian ad litem did not opine as to whether or not domestic abuse had occurred. But the guardian ad litem statutes and enabling powers are not something that allow her to investigate that. She's a parenting time and best interest analysis, and the guardian specifically testified that they do not investigate and opine as to whether or not the domestic abuse occurred. So whether or not she believes that wouldn't have been in the report. Uh, I should give you the quote for that case I talked about earlier. That's Fidelity versus Fitzsimmons, 261 Northwest 2nd, 586. It's out of 1977, and it was discussed as part of a footnote under the differences in a 4102B standard, so, or what was the equivalent then, it was renumbered, but thank you.
Counsel, if the case had proceeded and the court had turned to Danielle to present her case, and she just said, we rest, we didn't have nothing to offer, wouldn't the court just be deciding the case then at that point?
Yes, and we'd still be here if the same order had been issued, because when you look at a prima facie burden and a burden of production, those items are presumed unless they're contradicted, except when you weigh evidence and weigh credibility. And I keep coming back to the fact that the judge didn't weigh the credibility of anybody. She did not talk about the credibility of these witnesses and didn't say why she discounted the statements by Ms. Tunin and Ms. Upsall that that mom injured the child reported that, and child was scared of mom. So.
Thank you, Mr. Cantor.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is James Carlson. I'm here on behalf of Ms. Oldenburg. Your Honors, I have had the ability to be in the same courtroom with Mr. Cantor in the past. I have, in fact, been on this case for about 8 years, so I do know quite a bit of the history with regards to this. I believe that Your Honor hit it square on the head, saying that there is essentially a determination that has been made by the court here. Whether or not the judge said, hey, listen, I'm doing it based upon a motion for an involuntary dismissal or not, she did, in fact, weigh the evidence. I don't think it's fair to say that she didn't weigh the evidence. The judge very clearly in her order went through and talked about the guardian ad litem. She ends up discussing the fact that she found the guardian ad litem's testimony to be credible and that she found the report to be invaluable in reaching the decision. Your Honors, with regards to this, the rulings, what happened is that Mr. Cantor, on behalf of his client, filed and is asking on page one of his brief, he's asking that the court reverse and remand the matter for further consideration by the district court. With all due respect, this is a matter of the rulings, Rule 41 versus Rule 52. This was done by a judge. This was not heard by a jury. And so the fact of the matter is that they ended their case in chief. They put on a complete case that they asked for. They rested. After they rested, as the Rule 41.02 allows for, a motion was made at that point to involuntarily dismiss the matter based upon the motion. Judge took it into consideration. We didn't waive our rights to end up putting on a case. If the judge had come back and said, well, I'm not going to end up making specific findings under 52.01, we still had the ability to end up putting on our case. And with all due respect, Your Honor, Judge Kirk, this is exactly what I was going to get into, is to say, if in fact the judge had ruled and said, well, we're not going to give an involuntary dismissal based upon the motion, my client would have stood up, or I would have stood up and said, we rest. We don't have to present anything because they haven't raised to the burden, or they haven't reached the burden of essentially proving their case by a preponderance of
evidence. Why did you stipulate to the medical records rather than have the doc testify?
To be quite honest with you, we'd been into court. I can tell you these parties have spent literally hundreds of thousands of dollars in hearings, and I don't believe that the medical records had anything to do with the outcome, to be quite honest with you. So it was a matter of, are we going to continue this matter where my client is essentially going to continue to not have parenting time with the child so that we can get in here to get a doctor present. So at that time, we said, take the records. Okay, understanding that we got to end up arguing, or I guess I should say cross-examining the petitioner and say, hey, you in fact are the individual that told the doctor this, correct? And we actually have more records that I don't think were brought up. There are records that were in fact brought to the doctor that said he has made false allegations in the past. This treating doctor did not know that when he wrote the reports.
Probably most wouldn't, you know, especially in a bigger community.
Absolutely, and that was my point. So I'm saying that you essentially have one party that comes in with the child, who the child's been with the entire time, and the dad says, oh, by the way, there's been this history of essentially domestic abuse, and there's been all these findings. There has not been one single finding that has been in favor of the appellant in this case. He has made three allegations just in the year 2023. With all due respect, I was actually here and argued on this exact same case, the same parties, I should say, Your Honors, in the past, in which case this court ruled again and said, no, you don't get to end up throwing out the district court judge's discretionary call. They heard all the evidence. In this situation here, Your Honor, with all due respect, the best case scenario for Mr. Cantor is that this case were to essentially be reverted back to the district court, in which case we go in and we say, all right, we're not going to put on any evidence. There doesn't need to be, because she has, in fact, weighed everything. She has, in fact, put in her report that she had two of the teachers that have been involved for years testified. She heard all the testimony. I think what Mr. Cantor is trying to say, and I disagree with that completely, I think the reason why the statute is written like it is, or the rules are written, 5201 is written that way, is because of the idea that Mr. Cantor's interpretation would mean that we have to believe and take every single thing as true that the petitioner, in this case the appellant, puts into the report. And we have to essentially ignore every bit of the other testimony. That's not what the case law says. That's not what the statute says. It says it has to be viewed in the light most favorable to the appellant. That was done. The judge actually said, hey, listen, I've reviewed these other things, and based upon that, there is no shred of evidence aside from the petitioner's self-serving testimony. Those are words directly from the judge. What you don't understand, and I believe that we did put into our brief, and I shouldn't say you don't understand that, that's not what I mean, but what needs to be understood is that this guardian wrote a report that is 15 to 20 pages longer than any other report that there was. There is a 33-page report that goes into the history of this case all the way back to 2016. When all of this essentially started. And it talks about, and the judge has all of this information. They're in the best position to end up judging the credibility of all this. It talks about the literally time and time and time again that the petitioner continues to file false reports. He and his mother are the individuals that call CPS. Every one of those cases has come back. Every one of the CPS cases has been closed without findings, and there's been no police that have been involved that have said we're going to pursue anything at all. Quite the contrary. The only thing that has happened is the petitioner, or in this case the appellant, has in fact been charged with in the past a domestic abuse. And with regards to this minor, the appellant in the past has had OFPs against him and OFPs against him on behalf of my client. Your Honor, there is no abuse of discretion here that happened. We had the Judge Perkiel, with all due respect, who initially heard this hearing. She's now retired, or had left the bench, essentially. She also had a history from the family law case, because she was actually blocked to this case. When she left, the case got reassigned and it went to Judge Marks. Judge Marks got that. And now I can tell you, because of the litigious nature of all this, the family law case is now assigned to another judge.
What's the custody status right now?
Custody status is 50-50 parenting time, equal parenting time. However, we actually have an issue that we've brought before the court because my client has been essentially without the child for almost 26 days because, once again, the
That's appellant, outside of our record,
it,
though.
It is, but with all the respect, he did ask, and that's why I was saying.
Certainly,
so we
are,
yes. So we are now going to be going back to court, with all due respect, Your Honor. But as you saw on the order that was here, actually even Judge Perkiel's order, she turned around and she, sua sponte, made an order and said, I'm going to reinstate all of my client's parenting time. Not only that, but they're going to essentially give my client compensatory parenting time. Didn't end up modifying the order at all, other than to say, of course, you guys can't end up using corporal punishment for your child. Aside from that, nothing had changed. Nothing had changed when we came into the courtroom with regards to this case either, Your Honor, the OFP. With all due respect, Your Honor, in the best case scenario, again, for Mr. Cantor, he has asked that the matter be remanded to the court for further findings, for further consideration. Doesn't mean that he gets to end up having a retrial. It essentially means, okay, they've already rested. So at that point, my client would then put on her case in chief, of which we know the judge has already determined. I've weighed the credibility. I've essentially said, okay, I'm going to deny it. So there doesn't have to be a 28 or a 22-point conclusions of law along with the findings, Your Honor. It simply comes down and says, didn't reach the burden, and it's dismissed. With all due respect, Your Honor, we're going to be right back here again. You heard counsel advise that even if it were to have gone by a matter where Judge Marks turns around and makes a ruling after we put our case forward, his statement was we'd be right back here because there are not distinct or specific findings. There doesn't have to be. With all due respect, they
Judge
did
Marks
find
Judge Marks have the case that's pending now?
No, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
So you don't have a one judge, one family rule in the first?
I think, to be quite honest with you, I think Mr. Cantor and I, or Mr. Maher and I, actually talked about that, having it assigned, and I think we assumed it was going to be assigned to Judge Marks, but at that point they assigned it to a different judge, and I'm guessing because they were figuring one was on an OFP calendar and one was on a family law calendar. To be quite honest with you, I don't know, and I'd be speculating to say why they assigned it to a new judge. But it is with a new family law judge. If this were to be remanded, of course, it would go back to Judge Marks. And I will tell you, the 33-page report that is referenced here is now in the family law court. It has been, by stipulation, it has been agreed to and part of the filings and part of the actual file in the family law case now, by stipulation. With regards to that, Your Honor, we'd ask that you dismiss the motion at this point, leave the findings the way they are. In the event that you are going to consider the idea of this has to go back to the district court, again, Your Honor, I would advise that this should simply go back for further consideration. It's not a retrial. It is a remand that they are asking for. I don't think we even get there because there's absolutely no abuse that was done here by the judge. In anything, or in the worst case scenario, it is a harmless error, just as you had advised Judge Warkey in the idea of saying, listen, couldn't she just turn around and say, all right, I did it as an involuntary dismissal based upon a motion, but really it's going to be my findings without the respondent in that situation putting on any kind of a case, Your Honor. With all due respect, I'd ask the matter be dismissed. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Cantor.
Mr. Canton.
Thank you, Your Honor. A couple of factual things that I want to address. At the first OFP hearing in December of 2023 now, Judge Perkiel was going to, who had familiarity with the file, was going to dismiss on Mr. Carlson's motion at that time. We requested that she have an in-camera review with the child. She came back out and said, absolutely not. I am ordering a guardian ad litem, and we're going to have a full contested matter. So the single time that a judge listened to this child, a guardian was appointed. Now, if it's true that if we go back...
Sponte on her part, I mean, a judge doesn't have to listen to a child. And
nope.
Frankly, I think that's a hard decision to make and a hard position for a judge to be in.
I completely agree with that, Your Honor.
What did you call the child as a witness?
That's what I was just going to address now, Your Honor. The day of the trial, it was Ms. Oldenburg's custody day. Her boyfriend, Adam, I don't remember his last name off the top of my head, took the child out of school, and he was
not...
Getting
an awful lot of information that's not in our record. I mean, we understand the issue, but and I appreciate the background, but we can't consider that. We can't consider what happened. You didn't have the child testify.
That's correct. If we go back, we will be making a motion to reopen just for that. I will say that. Because I think that's appropriate. When people listen to the child and they don't get bogged down into what the dad says against the mom and the mom says against the dad, the child is credible and the child's being not served by the court right now.
Yes. I thought I saw some indication in the record in the briefs that the child has made false allegations about being beaten up at school. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, there was an issue about the child being in a fight at school, and I would say that that is kind of on par with what I believe Judge Work mentioned earlier with kids getting hurt. You know, if you're in a fight on the schoolyard and you're called into the principal's office, it's going to take a while probably to get to the true story. That's kids being kids.
But I mean, that sort of would take away from, well, as long as they hear, as soon as... Once they hear the child, everything will be clear.
Yeah.
But that would presume the child will be credible, and there's some indication that the child will not be credible.
Yep. That you're correct, but in order to impeach his credibility, then mom, Ms. Oldenburg, would have to take the stand and say, no, this isn't what happened, because those are the two that were present. And then it gets into the credibility of who's the more credible witness.
Fair to say, though, counsel, the guardian ad litem has interviewed the child.
Yep.
Probably multiple times.
I believe there was two, maybe three interviews. I know there was one at mom's house. I don't know if there was one at dad's house, and I believe there was one independent. But I don't remember if it's two or three. I apologize for that.
Okay.
Mr. Carlson did make an interesting point that he's making a argument that my position would be that all the allegations in the petition have to be taken at face value and is true, and that's not our position. However, if you look at the history of the case, the petition did have medical records attached. The judge who reviewed the medical records did find that there was probable cause, or I don't know what the standard is on an ex parte, it's not probable cause, but did find that there was a basis for adopting an ex parte and believed the medical records. So we already had one independent judge look at the medical records and say, yeah, this is sufficient. We had another judge who looked at the medical records and spoke to the child and appointed a guardian. I have no understanding, and there's nothing in the record as to why this judge, Judge Marks, discounted the medical records as heavily as she did. And I think that's reversible error. And unless there's any other questions, I'll rest.
Thank you. Thank you to both counsel for appearing today. The matters are submitted. A decision will be issued in the statute.